This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Once again this week, we have lots of news from Richmond as the 2018 General Assembly completed its first full week of work. We'll get to those reports a little later in this half hour. We also hear a warning from the leader of the region's largest food bank of potential cuts to food assistance in the federal government's budget. That report from WMRA's Christopher Clymer Kurtz. But first, last weekend marked the second year of a unique confluence of parades, unique, that is, to the small city of Lexington, which again this year saw the traditional Lee Jackson Day parade with marchers in period Confederate uniform marking the holiday. Lexington is the burial place for Southern generals Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, is one of the few cities that even allows such celebrations every year. But for the second year in a row, and 2 days later this year, on the national Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, a different group marched to celebrate the civil rights leader's legacy. But something else was different this year: the specter of racist violence in Charlottesville last August. So security was very tight in Lexington last weekend, as WMRA's Faith Pinu reports.
Confederate stars and bars rippled through Lexington on Saturday as people in war regalia and period costumes marched in the yearly parade honoring Generals Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. Yesterday, the streets again filled with marchers, these carrying a rainbow assortment of signs honoring civil rights leader Martin Luther King and proclaiming justice, equality, and peace for all. This year, extra precaution was taken to ensure that both events happened peacefully. City Council member Marilyn Alexander said that nobody wanted a repeat of what happened in Charlottesville.
As soon as that event took place in Charlottesville, we immediately started the think tank about what if.
State police and forces from several surrounding localities joined Lexington police in swarming the streets over the weekend. Field Commander Lieutenant Michael Frost said he spent hours creating contingency plans, but in the end, the weekend's events went smoothly.
I think both parades went exceptionally well. There was no major hiccups. Everybody got along well, and the resources that we had in reserve were not needed, so I think it went as well as it could actually go.
According to the organizer's website, members of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, the United Daughters of the Confederacy, and other Southern historical organizations have gathered every year since 2000 to commemorate the two generals buried in Lexington. These annual rallies are also in part a protest of a decision by Lexington City Council in 2011 to ban the Confederate flag on city-owned property. Barry Eisenhower, spokesperson for the Virginia Flaggers Group, said this was his eighth year coming to Lexington from Richmond.
That's what we do. We come here and honor them because they were great civic leaders as well as military leaders, spiritual leaders. So we come here to honor them because we honor our American veterans.
Attendees on Lee Jackson Day emphasized that the focus of their parade was history, to remember the generals for their contribution to the war. Tim McCurry from Morristown, Tennessee, wore full Confederate gray uniform and carried a replica of the first Confederate national flag. He said he marches to keep the history and education of the Confederacy alive.
I don't associate with white supremacists or those that stand up for quote-unquote the white race. That's not my thing. It's not what the Confederate veterans themselves would have stood for or would have believed in.
For others, the weekend offered an opportunity to take a stand for a Southern identity. Creighton Lovelace, a pastor from North Carolina, spoke at the Lee Jackson Day Memorial Service and urged his audience to stand up for a Southern heritage that he said is being erased.
We are under ethnic cultural cleansing is what we're seeing. Either the South is writhing and screaming and hollering because either A, she is being reborn, or B, she is on her deathbed dying. And I will not be quiet about it.
The Martin Luther King Day Parade was created by the Lexington organization Community Anti-Racism Effort, or CARE. The group started in 2016 as a grassroots response to Ku Klux Klan recruitment in the city. Robin LeBlanc, a founding member of CARE, said they marched for King and for love.
I think this is his spirit right here, right? I do. You just put your body in the street with no intention of violence, and you just stand there representing your commitment to justice and equality and inclusion for all. And people did it, and I think he would have been thrilled to see the diversity of the crowd.
Last year, CARE applied for a permit that allowed them to hold their parade at the same time that the Sons of Confederate Veterans Parade usually takes place. This year, the city gave each group a permit to hold the parades on separate days. Here's another CARE founding member, history professor T.J. Talley.
Last year was an extraordinarily important parade where we needed to sort of take up space that had been sort of historically taken away from us and to really state this is what our community is. This is not about people coming from out of town and sort of making Lexington against its will about Lee Jackson Day. This is instead a ground-up community-based event that says this is who we are and what our values are.
Still, participants in both the Lee Jackson and Martin Luther King Day parades agreed that there is room for both groups to honor their heroes. Here's Dami Lawal, a Washington and Lee University law student at the King Parade.
I do think that the fact that both of them can happen shows the strength of America, right? That we can, that we are acceptable, right? We're acceptable of things even if we don't agree with it.
And Lillian McCurry, a Lee Jackson Day marcher from Morristown, Tennessee. She said that if she didn't have work, she would have stayed in town to march in the King Parade too.
You can say Lee Jackson Day and you can say Martin Luther King Day. It's not a crime. You know, you don't have to be on one side or the other.
For WMRA News, I'm Faith Pinu.
President Trump's 2018 budget proposal last year called for a 25% cut to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. As members of Congress continue to look for ways to cut the federal budget, one local food bank leader says that even a 10% cut in the program would hurt those in need. WMRA's Christopher Clymer-Kurtz reports.
The Blue Ridge Area Food Bank distributes food for about 22 million meals a year across 25 Virginia counties and 8 cities, but nationwide, SNAP provides 10 times as much food assistance as do food banks. That's according to Blue Ridge Area Food Bank CEO Michael McKee. He said SNAP is one of the most efficient federal programs and provides needed assistance to many of the people who also frequent food pantries. McKee is worried about proposals in Congress to cut funding for SNAP.
The idea, according to some members of Congress, is, well, we want to be sure to help those who need it, but we don't want to be providing benefits to those who really don't.
A statement on the Republican-led House Committee on Agriculture SNAP website said that, quote, churches, food banks, and other local organizations are simply better equipped than the federal government in some areas. But McKee said that scaling up to meet greatly increased demands from cuts is something that food banks and the pantry networks they supply aren't able to do. Funding cuts would also deal a blow to grocery retailers, where SNAP benefits are spent, he said.
It is one of the most misguided policy recommendations I've seen come out of Congress in the last year, and that's saying something.
For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
The Senate committee that deals with elections and conflicts of interest last week voted down a measure that would have blocked campaign contributions from public service corporations. Soraya Wintersmith with our partner station WCVE in Richmond reports.
The bill, SB 10, was a second attempt by Fairfax Senator Chap Peterson. When rolling out his legislative agenda last May, he said the donation ban would be a priority issue for him this session.
We need to step back and look at how much power and influence is being wielded by these public monopolies.
Back then, Peterson stressed that even though Dominion Energy is often cited in talks about the issue because of its frequent bipartisan political campaign contributions, he doesn't mean to badmouth the company or its employees.
Let me dispel any inference that Dominion or the people that work for Dominion is a bad company or that they're doing anything nefarious. It's not true. They're following the law, and their lobbyists are representing their clients' interests, and that's exactly what they're supposed to do, and my hat is off to them for the great work that they're doing. My problem is with the system that gives them too much power.
According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, Virginia is one of 6 states that allows corporations to contribute an unlimited amount of money to state campaigns. 22 states bar corporations from contributing to political campaigns, and another 22 impose the same limits for individual and corporate contributions. During Virginia's 2017 campaign season, more than a dozen House of Delegates candidates pledged not to take money from Dominion or Appalachian Power. 13 of those candidates won their races. Additionally, then-candidate Ralph Northam called for a ban on corporate campaign contributions in Virginia and a $10,000 cap on individual donations. Peterson echoed some of those thoughts when he presented his bill to the Senate Privileges and Elections Committee Tuesday evening. He brought no witnesses and said he didn't expect the bill to pass.
But I'm here today to tell you that I think this is an important issue, and I appreciate your consideration. And if you could poke holes in this bill saying that there are ways to get around it, you are absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. I will also say that are there First Amendment issues?
I'm sure probably someone's going to bring that argument up, say we have limits on contributions in every state as well as at the federal level. We had someone who just ran for governor talking about prohibiting all corporate contributions. Okay? I'm not looking to do that. I am looking at prohibiting contributions from this class of companies.
But Peterson's view that money from publicly regulated monopolies can corrupt Virginia's political process found little solidarity from Senate colleagues. The 14-member committee represents a collective total of more than $30,000 in campaign donations from Dominion Energy alone over the last year. Senator John Cosgrove from the Chesapeake City area has received more than $20,000 from Dominion Energy since 2002, according to the nonpartisan Virginia Political Access Project.
Certainly, we've been talking about this bill, and I'm sure Senator Peterson has the very best of intentions with this, but it'd be my motion to PBI.
And without much serious discussion, Senator Cosgrove made the motion to PBI, or pass the bill by, indefinitely. Republican Senator Bryce Reeves thanked Peterson for raising the issue, and Democratic Senator Adam Eben suggested the legislature needs to take up campaign reform without singling out public service corporations. The committee voted 12-2 to effectively kill the measure. The two legislators who opposed that motion were Republican Senator Amanda Chase and Democratic Senator Cree Deeds.
Soraya Wintersmith, WMRA News, Capitol Square.
Healthcare issues continue to vex Virginia's General Assembly, as made evident by one of Republican Senator William Stanley's bills that was discussed, voted down, and essentially reintroduced all last week. WCVE's Megan Pauley reports.
Last Friday, Patrick County community members like Jane Scales Folk lined up to testify in support of the legislation that would retroactively reinstate their community hospital's license to operate.
The hospital means a lot to us. It does. It's been there ever since I've been there. And it's closed and lost us over 140 jobs that we cannot lose.
The rural hospital closed last summer after its owner, Pioneer Health Systems, filed for bankruptcy. Stanley's bill would extend the hospital's license, known as a COPN, or Certificate of Public Need. Democratic Senator George Barker says that's important if the hospital wants to operate under new ownership.
They need this legislation to get somebody to buy it, because nobody is going to put up the money to buy it if they're not certain whether they can get the license to reopen it.
Senator Stanley advocated for his bill when it came up for a vote on the Senate floor Tuesday, telling the compelling history of the community-funded hospital.
They had a minimum to raise of $300,000, Mr. President, and what they did was every paycheck that they took back in the 50s to the early 60s, they took out 70 cents.
But the bill didn't pass, leaving Stanley stunned.
The people you talk about wanting to help in that other issue that you wanted me to vote on are the people you're hurting.
That other issue, Medicaid expansion. Democratic Senator Janet Howell responded to Stanley's frustration.
Thank you. I'm really sorry that we are starting with so much anger here in the Senate. But I will tell you, I'm angry also. I'm very angry that I have constituents, yes, even in Northern Virginia, even in wealthy Fairfax County and Arlington County, that have no health care.
While loss of revenue due to a lack of Medicaid expansion wasn't cited as the primary reason for Patrick County's hospital closure, the peer-reviewed journal Health Affairs recently found that hospital closures are much more common in states that haven't expanded Medicaid. Mark Merrill, chief financial officer of Valley Health Systems, says it's even more likely for those hospital closures to occur in rural areas where more people are uninsured. Merrill says he's personally seen a difference between the hospitals he operates in Virginia and those across the border in West Virginia.
Because of Medicaid expansion in West Virginia, our West Virginia critical access hospitals are positive. They're break-even or making a small profit. Our two critical access hospitals in Virginia are operating at a deficit, and that's because of West Virginia.
And he says providing quality care for those struggling with opioid addiction is a constant challenge.
Medicaid is a major payer of behavioral health services. You know, a lot of the drug addicted individuals, opioid addicted, they are without coverage, and their treatment options are very limited.
Meanwhile, Senator Stanley, who's opposed Medicaid expansion in previous years, continues to fight for Patrick County's hospital and introduced a bill identical to the one that failed in the Senate, just with a different number. In Richmond, I'm Megan Pauley, WMRA News.
Finally, for some analysis of this week's events at the Capitol and politically speaking around the Commonwealth, let's hear from Richmond Times-Dispatch political commentator Jeff Shapiro, speaking with WCVE's Craig Carper.
Jeff, in this first full week of the General Assembly, we have members in both chambers on both sides of the aisle lamenting the death of bipartisanship. Is this truly the end, or is this a lot of huffing and puffing?
Well, not a week into the new administration. The only thing that seems abundant at this point are bruised feelings. After 4 years of somewhat difficult relations between a Democratic governor, Terry McAuliffe, and a lopsidedly Republican General Assembly, there was this expectation, in part, I think, because the Republicans had been so dramatically humbled last November, losing 15 seats in the House of Delegates, that there might be a more peaceful and more productive legislature. But I think what remains of the Republican majority, these are areas of the state, for the most part, and there are exceptions, that still are strongly Republican, that they are Trump-friendly, so that the voters in these districts expect their Republican legislators to hold the line against this new Democratic governor. So it appears that all gun control bills are dead, that any bill that might give local government some authority over whether to retain these Confederate monuments, that legislation is gone. Bills intended to assure abortion rights, they seem to be fading fast. There was this fascinating move in which a dozen prized Democratic bills, instead of going to the committees that ordinarily would handle them, ended up in the Rules Committee, chaired by the Speaker of the House. But there are tiny bits of evidence that suggest that Republicans and Democrats actually will get along. Chris Jones, the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, a Republican, a more moderate Republican, met with the governor, talked about the budget, some of the challenges ahead, gave a floor speech in which he said that this was going to be a nonpartisan budget, promising development, presumably. This continuing romancing by every state and city in the country, it seems, of Amazon for its second headquarters, apparently making the cut, not Richmond, but perhaps four sites in Northern Virginia. The governor's office put out a statement that included remarks from Chris Jones and Tommy Normand, the majority leader of the Senate. So there is perhaps reason for optimism. Will that extend to Medicaid expansion? We'll see. There's a good chance the Republicans will figure out some way to dress that up so that maybe they can avail themselves of all that fat federal cash without looking like they're straying too far off the anti-Medicaid expansion plantation.
Jeff, I think everyone around the country gets nervous when the threat of a federal shutdown is looming, but perhaps no one more so than those of us in Virginia who are heavily dependent on federal largesse to boost our economy.
Federal spending, direct and indirect, accounts for about 30% of Virginia's economy. So when the federal government goes dark, there is considerable alarm. There's only one state ahead of Virginia in which federal spending per capita is higher, that'd be Alaska. Virginia is what it is largely because of federal beneficence. But this to-ing and fro-ing over federal spending and whether to keep the federal government open is also caught up in this immigration debate, which also resonates very powerfully in the new Virginia. 6% of Virginia's population is Hispanic. Another 6% of Virginia's population is Asian. These numbers appeared almost instantaneously in about a generation. So when Washington is teetering on the brink of going dark, people get nervous, and it's happened before. As I mentioned, in 2013, federal government was closed for 16 days. That frustrated a lot of people, made them quite angry, and it contributed to Terry McAuliffe's victory for governor. The two Democrats representing Virginia in the U.S. Senate, Mark Warner and Tim Kaine, came out strongly against a proposed House spending plan, saying that the only thing it did was promote government dysfunction. Governor Northam has been outspoken on this as well, and this could be a harbinger of something far more severe, and that would be sequestration, those mandatory, seemingly indiscriminate budget cuts that contributed to a $2.4 billion hole in the Virginia budget that wasn't fully closed until last year, in large part with those rainy day funds. We're in the process of trying to replenish that fund. Imagine trying to do that and balance a budget suffering from the body blow of yet another sequestration.
Jeff, you mentioned Senators Kaine and Warner, both of whom are pressing President Donald Trump to consider an exemption for Virginia to his opening up of all U.S. coastal waters for offshore drilling.
Of course, this exemption has been extended only to Florida. Hint, hint, a Trump-carried state. Virginia was not. But this is an issue that on which Democrats and Republicans are standing together. There's great concern about what offshore drilling for gas and or oil would mean, not just for the safety of coastal waters, the quality of the environment. Perhaps they would represent a threat to the military in terms of training and full and free operations off Virginia waters. Scott Taylor, freshman congressman from the 2nd District, which includes Virginia Beach, surprise, surprise, he's now opposed to offshore drilling. Governor Northam has added his voice as well. Early days in his political career was actually in favor of offshore drilling, but he's gotten religion on that issue.
Thanks to Jeff Shapiro, political columnist at the Richmond Times-Dispatch.
Have a good weekend.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Klein May Realty, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Nancy Barber, Pam and Jim Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. All our stories are archived at WMRA.org. If you'd like to support them, go to that website, mouse over news, then click on News and Information Fund. And be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. And here's a great way to keep up with local and statewide news each day with WMRA, including the latest on this year's General Assembly session. Subscribe to our daily news podcast, the WMRA Daily. It comes out every weekday. At WMRA.org, just look for the WMRA black coffee mug with the blue sticky note that says Daily. I'm Bob Levicki, WMRA's news director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.